How, out of curiosity, anybody brand new tonight? Okay, wait, leave them up. Okay, put them down. And everybody who was here last week, put your hand up. Okay, so I scared around half of you off, maybe. Okay, I'm just saying, this is always one of the things I like to do. It's like, okay, who came back? Who decided, not for me? I like to pretend that maybe they got sick or something happened, they couldn't come, and not just, wow, I am out of here. Or maybe they're just all going to come late because traffic was not there. Okay, for those of you that were not here last week, it's okay. We're going to go through a brief review, so you'll be just fine. My name is Sandy Carlson. This is Buddhism in a Nutshell, night 2 of 5. It is, what's the date today? 15th, January 15th. Okay. So my first thing is I'm going to make sure you can hear me, because I see, is the audio, because sometimes literally where you sit makes a difference with our audio system. You're okay? Because that's one of my things when I sit and I'm listening to some of the other class leaders or teachers, I have my favorite places to sit. So I'm just letting you know. Check it out. Don't be afraid to say, I didn't hear that. I didn't understand that. Say it again. So I think we're still people coming in. Okay. Out of the people that just came in, how many of you were here last week? Brand new. So again, one more time for me. Anybody that's here for the first time tonight? See, the people that just came in are new. Okay, I'm okay. That's loud. No, I did not. We might be doing this old school, people. Stall? Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah.
I did not bring... So, I have this old flip chart, one of those old flip charts that I used to have this on. I've carried it around. I've used it for like 5 years. It's just raggedy and everything. And I finally switched over to a PowerPoint when we got all this. And for the first time ever, I did not bring that flip chart. It just means I have to read more to you than... Yeah. We'll figure it out. We can just go on and you can work on it. Help us out. How about I'll just talk and you can put. Okay. So this is Chris, just so you know. He is actually, he'll say hi, Chris. So Chris takes care of all of the audio, visual, and stuff here, and he has to do this all on a shoestring budget. And if you ever go online to the Kadampa Center website, and we've got years of teachings and years of videos and years of these things, he's the one that's been doing it. So while we have a glitch here, that's okay. One of the things that we talk about is just the fact that we offer all of this to... So we still have people coming in. So we will move on. Just come on in. It's okay, we're just getting started. We've been stalling. There's even more people coming. Were you here last week, or is this first time? Just out of curiosity.
Oh, I was here.
Okay. I was going to say, I'm really scared a lot of people, but everybody's just coming in a little bit late. Okay, so, as I said, I was a little bit late coming tonight, and so I'm not as organized in my thoughts as I like to be. That's actually part of the practice. Way, way back in the day, years ago, my very first time that I ever led this class, I got in the car, and my car didn't start. And it was, I was frazzled. This is, I was all pumped up. I was all excited. It's going to be the first time I've led the class. One thing after the other. And it was just like, I was ready. And I got in the car and the car did not start. And I went into immediate frazzle, right? And I'm just like, oh no, what do I do? There was a little bit of swearing in there. I'm cleaning up my act here for you. And it was just like, I was just completely stumped over this. I just had a brain, couldn't even function. Because I'd had these expectations of how the night was going to go, and it totally blew. My husband, whom I adore with all of my heart, said to me, well, are you walking or are you talking? And it was like, he said, I will drive you. We can, I would do whatever you need to do to get you there, so let it go. But it was like, do you really practice what you're preaching, honey? Because right now it doesn't seem like it. And it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. As I started down this path of leading these classes, it's all of a sudden, it's like, okay, the unexpected, things have changed, and how adaptable is your mind? Because things are going to happen out there, but how do you react to it? And so that's a little bit the way I felt today. I've had just kind of one of these frazzling days, and then I wasn't able to leave for class on time. And this class is really important to me, and one of the reasons why I like leading this very basic beginner class is it's this constant reminder of what it is that I'm doing on this path. See you, Chris! That was a pretty big stall. I thought I did pretty good, huh? So it's one of these things that one of the things I like to do when starting the class is let's just close our eyes. We're going to do a very brief meditation and set our intention for class and just kind of get focused here. For those of you that are new, I'll talk about this a little bit, but I'm going to dive into it and then I'm going to back up and do a review. We have a meditation posture that we do. We talked about this meditation posture, the 7-point meditation posture. I'm going to go through the entire thing at the beginning again. So that I can bring everybody else up to speed, and it's very good review for you. But my plan is, at the beginning of every class, we're going to do a brief meditation, and at the end of every class, we're going to do a brief meditation. These are on the handouts on the website. Again, I'll explain it a little bit more, but I would like to get into it a little bit. So just for those of you that are brand new, go with me for a couple of minutes here, and I will explain what we're doing as we go, and then we're going to talk about it afterwards. But for right now, it's just bringing our attention just quietly to the room. Take a deep breath, and there's actually a meditation posture that we use, and there's specific reasons that we do it. So I'm going to read it so that I do it correctly, because I tend to do it automatically in my head. And let's just set our intention and are focused in to this room tonight. So the 7-point meditation posture, and the first thing is the legs. If possible, sitting with your legs, if you're sitting on the mat, feel free to check it out if you want to try. For those of you that want to try the meditation, sitting down here and then get back up in the chair, go back and forth. This is a very open class. And so if you'd like to, if you're sitting in a chair, sit with your feet flat on the ground. It's nice to have a cushion if you're shorter. Put your feet on the ground. And then if you're sitting like Asia is sitting, she's got the perfect posture, so we're just going to admire for a moment. But sit, take your arms, hold your hands loosely in your lap. They can be on, your hands can be on your knees. We tend to do, we put our right hand in our left, put our fingers together, take kind of a teardrop, and base that just slightly below our navel. And what does that do? The reason for this is everything in this is very common sense. If we're trying to create a stable position so we can hold a meditation posture for a long time, when we do this and we have our arms kind of akimbo, it allows air to flow so that you don't get tight, you don't get sweaty. It allows air to flow around your body. Your back is very important. It needs to be straight but not stiff. If you're sitting in a chair, don't lean back. Just sit up just a little bit so you've kind of tilted your pelvis and it's straight and fully upright. I kind of add the shoulders to the back when I'm thinking about it. You open up, push your shoulders back a little bit, and you're kind of opening your chest. That's allowing your airways to breathe a little bit. And for those who might be into this, we won't go into it. This opens up your energy channels. So it's just bringing your shoulders back, relaxing comfortably. Your back is straight but not totally stiff. Your eyes. In the beginning, it's very helpful. Sometimes people like to meditate with their eyes closed. If you're in a perfect world, your eyes are just slightly open, you know, not focused, but generally looking a little bit, maybe 3-4 feet in front of you. Why is that? If you're closed, your eyes, you can get sleepy. If they're wide open and looking out, you can get distracted. So it's just slowly closing your eyes just a little bit. Go ahead and close them if you need to right now. At the beginning, that's just fine. The next step is your jaw and your mouth. You don't want to be clenched because this isn't a force thing, so relax your jaw and your mouth. Your teeth may be slightly apart and your lips slightly touching. Your tongue should be resting lightly on the roof of your mouth just behind your teeth. It sounds very detailed. Why is that, Sandy? Because it helps to lessen the flow of saliva. Again, you're trying to create this position that you can hold for a long time, and everything about this position is something that allows you to create this more stable set piece so that you can let go of your body, let go of concentrating on your body while you're learning to work with your mind. Your head is slightly tipped forward, and again, part of it is so it's not upright to get the distraction. It's not totally down because you could snooze. It's slightly tipped forward. One of the little things I like to pretend is like maybe there's a string at the top of my crown that I'm pulling, and that keeps my head, the crown of my head, aligned with my back. And all of these things are again, this is just a stable position to help you to forget about your body a little bit and not worry about it as you learn to work with your mind as you meditate. And I'm going to do a very simple meditation. This is a guided meditation. And I'm going to switch, and I'm going to go to one of my favorites, and I'll explain why later. Okay, take a couple of just deep breaths. This is called counting the breath. This is a good technique for building your concentration. So first, calm your mind. Focus your attention on your breathing and breathe naturally. Focus your mind on the rising and falling of your shoulders and chest as you inhale and exhale gently. Allow your mind to settle, become calm and present, and ready to engage in meditation. We're going to set a motivation. We are going to create an altruistic motivation for this meditation session. Think that you are meditating not just for your own individual benefit, but you're taking the time now to meditate and develop your mind to become a wiser and kinder person, able to be of benefit to all beings. That's the Mahayana motivation. We'll talk about that more in a little bit. Also, a simpler one is maybe just tonight I'm going to open my mind if there's even one thing that I can take from tonight that helps me to be a kinder, gentler, happier person, then that's phenomenal. So I'm just going to be open to the evening. So we're going to start by focusing our attention at the opening of the nostrils. Pay attention to the very subtle sensation as you breathe in and out through your nose. You can feel certain sensations as the air passes, as the small hairs move. Cooler sensations as you inhale, warmer as you exhale. Don't follow the air all the way into your body or out into the surrounding environment. Just place your attention on the sensations associated with the breath at the opening of your nostrils. And your job is to keep your attention firmly placed on those sensations only. As you inhale and exhale, We're going to start mentally counting each inhalation and exhalation together as one. So in, out, that's one. In, out, that's two. I want you to count from 1 to 10, concentrating on those sensations. When you reach 10, begin again at 1. If you become distracted, if your mind wanders and moves away from the concentration, then I need you to begin at 1 again. So I'm going to take 2 minutes. I'm going to be quiet for 2 minutes while you do this. Breathing in and out is 1. Breathe normally, breathe naturally. Make it to 10 and start over for 2 minutes. Slowly bring your attention back to the room, and we're going to dedicate this positive energy and this just little bit of effort that we put into calming our mind for the benefit and happiness of all sentient beings, including yourself. Okay, so has anybody in this room, was this the very first time you did a meditation? A couple of people. All right. I'm going to do a bit of a review, and we're going to talk about this, but for just a brief glimpse of meditation is the main tool that Buddhists use to look at our minds. And there's two different kinds of meditation: concentration meditation and analytical meditation. So I'm kind of coming in this way, and then I'm going to back up and review just for those who weren't here to let them know what we just did. So concentration meditation is, it's learning to start to focus our minds. We're focusing on an object. We're focusing on just one thing. In this case, it was the breath. We were counting the breath. Okay, so concentration meditation, a lot of times, you know, people use the breath. They'll use a picture. They can use a light. You can use a sound. You're concentrating on one thing, and that just calms the mind down. The practice of meditation is to become familiar with. So we're to become familiar with our minds, because all of our minds, that's what this practice is all about, is just working with your mind. And so part of what we're going to do is we're going to have just a brief meditation at the beginning of class, and I want to do a brief meditation at the end of class. I'd like to, my plan is to do one particular meditation. We're going to try to stick all with concentration meditations at the beginning, and then maybe at class 5 we'll do an analytical meditation so you can see the difference. It's the analogy would be if you're going to be in sports, that before you would go do any major, you know, marathon or something, you've got to practice so you can build up to it. So that's what concentration meditation is we're strengthening the focus of the mind so that we can, when we go to an analytical meditation where we're going to go run that marathon, we've got better power to use our minds. And so what I'd like to do is start with a meditation, end with a meditation, and I'll try to, if I can do this the way I'd like to start with one, end class with one, and then the next class we'll do that particular meditation that we ended the last class with, so that you get a chance to do like two of the same one. The reason that I'm going to do that is because there are different types and different styles of this concentration meditation with using the breath. You may like one, he may like another one. So it's kind of letting you touch different things and see what might work for you. That particular meditation that we just did, counting the breaths, is one of my favorites. Even after, you know, 12, 15 years of studying, my meditation practice, whenever I go sit down, I always have to start, you know, you get your own little routine going, and I always start with that counting the breaths one. It just works for me to focus me in. Now, I'm going to be honest, because that's what I will be with you. I will try always to be honest. So you're supposed to do that, and you're supposed to count to 10, and then start over and count to 10, and start over and count to 10. I have been all the way up at like 89 before I've gone. You know, so talk about not being focused. I get in my own little rhythm, and I'm just counting breaths, and I'm just there. So that's a little mindless. So when you're focusing, it's trying to be aware. And then once you get that, you've got that, you've settled, then you can move on to analytical meditation, which is truly working with the mind on different things that you choose to, whether it's anger, compassion, or whatever you want to try to work on. So I'll try to do it to where you can experience a couple of different types of concentration meditation. And then at class 5, we'll try to do, I'll save enough time to where we can truly do a good analytical meditation. So, again, since for those of you that are new, one of the things I really like to do is try to open this up, and I like discussion and questions and talking. This is a safe place. People have come because they're curious. Last week we did, I had everybody introduce themselves and talk about where they were at, where they're from, you know, any experiences with Buddhism, so that we all realize that we're all pretty much here, in some cases, very similar stories. Curiosity. I just want to check it out. I've been circling Buddhism, and I just want to figure it out. I really don't know anything. I know a little bit. I've read something. So curiosity is a great reason to come. This is a safe place. You can ask me pretty much anything, and I'll try to give you a straight answer. If I don't know it, I pretty much know who does know the answers. There's no dumb questions, man. I am the queen of dumb questions. So just go ahead and ask them, and don't worry about it. I will explain everything. Again, this is just an open, safe place because, you know, it took a lot of courage sometimes to go into a Buddhist center. You know, you have no clue what's going to be in there. You have, you know, you hear all these different things. And so it can take a lot to just take those first steps. This is the second class of Buddhism in a nutshell. The website is kadampa-center.org. For those of you that have not been on the website, the handouts, a lot of the handouts that I will be going through are up on the website. If you, again, I'm doing a repeat for some of you that were here last week, but for those of you that weren't, if you go to the website, kadampacenter.org, go to Spiritual Programs, go to Introductory Programs, go to Buddhism in a Nutshell, all of the handouts that we're talking about are in there. There's the meditation handouts, the 7-point meditation posture is there, and there's other things. The Four Noble Truths that is going to be the base for the teaching. So before I go any further, does anybody that was here last week have any questions from the class? Just so I can make sure that I cover any of those. I did not reach out. I got too busy and forgot, I'm being honest, on your question. So that's, I'm telling you straight up. So, like I said, I will always be honest and not make the excuses of all these different things. I flat out didn't even think about it until about half an hour before I had to come tonight, and I went, so there you go. I'll try to do better. Okay. So So what we're going to do tonight is we're going to do a brief review. I may go a little bit more in depth because we have so many people here, a brief review of the general history of Buddhism. And then I really want to get into a more detailed discussion about the mind. Okay, we've got to set our tone with what does that mean, and using the Four Noble Truths, that's the Buddha's first teaching, is kind of our guide to this whole class. So let's move this. Out of curiosity from the meditation, was anybody thinking, because I will try to tell you, okay, I'm going to take 2 minutes, I'm going to take 3 minutes, okay, how many did pretty good on the breath? How many did pretty good about counting? Okay, now be honest, okay? Now you don't have to raise your hand like this, not this time, but I want you to be honest with yourself. How many of you were, oh my God, this feels so long, is 2 minutes up yet? So it's just, I want you to think about this, because I'll tell you, because one of the obstacles to meditation sometimes is time and not knowing how long you've been sitting there, and you kind of tend to lose track, and sometimes 2 minutes can feel like forever. And so that's one of the things I want to do, so is to let you know that, and later as we go, maybe we'll stretch it out, but I'll always try to let you know, okay, I'm going to do 2 minutes, I'm going to do 3 minutes, okay? And I guarantee you, there are going to be people going, she lost track of time, we've been sitting here forever. I guarantee you that that's going to happen, but this is where I want you to be aware of your mind and trying to listen to these things and not thinking, oh, I got to remember to stop and pick up milk on the way home. Oh, I've got to, you know, get that paperwork done for work tomorrow. This is your opportunity to be here. This is your opportunity to be here. So you made the effort to be here. So let's try to keep our minds here. I say this to you, and I'm talking to myself too. That's one of the reasons I love to lead this class. So, okay, let's do our brief review. And then I want to get into really more of the mind. For those of you that are new tonight, we have 5 classes. We get to kind of skip along the top of these subjects. We're going to be talking about the mind tonight, going into a little bit more detail because we just touched on it. And then maybe toward the end, depending on how fast we go, we might be getting into more of the concepts like karma and rebirth and some of these things. And then we're going to be getting into, we'll go into those in much more detail in the 4th class. And then the 5th class, we'll really get into some of the discussions about, you know, deeper, what are some of those deeper concepts of emptiness and some of those things. But I just have the time to kind of touch on things, so we don't do any real deep dive in this class. So if we start to go deep, I'm going to pull us back up, okay? We have other classes for that. Okay, beginner course. Again, I'm just going to kind of run through this because people are here for the first time. So that brief history, I'm going to do it real brief. How about this? The Buddha was a man. He lived about 2,500 years ago, and then he died, and that was it. He was just a man. He is not a god. This is one of the first things I get out of there right away. He was a prince. Siddhartha Gautama, it was over 2,500 years ago when he was born. His parents, the king and the queen, had a reading done over him. They'd had a seer come in and do this reading, and it was, and again, you can put yourself in that time frame, the king was told that your son is going to be a great man. He's either going to be a great king or he's going to be a great spiritual leader. And like anybody else, we tend to want our children to grow up in our footsteps, right? And the king really wanted the prince to become a great king. So he sheltered him from a lot of the things in the world. He tried to keep him in this safe. We all do that with our children. We want them to be safe. We cocoon them. You know, we take care of them. We don't want them to see bad things or go through bad things. So he led a very sheltered life. It was said that he was a very introspective young man, a very handsome young man. The king had him get married early in life. Again, trying to kind of wrap him up in this cotton wool and control his life a little bit more. But like any teenager, like any young man, he snuck out of the palace. My kids used to do that all the time. So he would sneak out of the palace with his friends and go out into the villages. And he saw four sights. I'm going to really run through this quickly. There's lots of books. The historical facts are just, to me, kind of that straightforward knowledge. I really prefer the concepts and stuff. I'm not a Buddhist historian. But he saw four sights, a sick person, an old person, a dead body, and a wandering mendicant. Oh, another monk. Okay? And those sights bothered him greatly. It's those questions we all ask in life. Why does that happen? Why do people get sick? Why are people aging? You know, why do people have to die? Why do our loved ones have to die? What is life all about? These are all of those things that he was just churning on. And there just came this time where he just couldn't take it anymore. He had this life of absolute luxury, but he was really unhappy. And so he left. Now, we don't ever say that leaving your wife and kids and your house is the right thing to do. This is just what he did. So he went off. He went off and he studied with all of these teachers all around India. People kind of forget that Buddhism really started in India. And so there was all of these different teachers of all of these different, you know, Hindu religions and all the different ways that they can do this. There were all these great teachers. And he learned and studied with all of these different great teachers and yogis. And he was learning a lot, and he would surpass them in knowledge, and he just kept learning, but he still wasn't finding answers. And so then he fell in with a group of these other men that were also seekers, also trying to find all of these answers. And he went from the one end of the spectrum of having everything to the other end of the spectrum of living this ascetic life, nothing. Some of the historical stories where they subsisted on one grain of rice. And so they were meditating and going through these practices and just really breaking it down and turning everything in the world off. You see these pictures of these statues and stuff where you can see like every rib in there, and that's kind of that portrayal of that period. So he went from one extreme to the other. And then there came the time that he, as the story goes, that he left the group and he went down and he was laying by this river, and this, along the water came this gentleman in a boat. And he was a musician. He was playing his instrument, maybe similar to a lute, guitar, that type of thing. And the Buddha noted that, you know, the beautiful music that was coming, and the musician said, if the strings are too loose, they don't sound good, and if they're too tight, they don't sound good. So they have to be strung perfectly in the middle to get this beautiful sound. And so he had that kind of aha moment of the middle way. You can't have both extremes. You just kind of have to go just right in the middle. It's okay. Don't take it on either side. Again, I'm doing a brief synopsis here for you guys. And so just that middle way. I've done both extremes and none of that is working. So what he did, there was a young woman villager that took care of him, brought him back to health, and then he left, and he went to Bodh Gaya. And he sat under the Bodhi tree and he looked at his mind. And there's a whole, like I said, a bunch of stories that go there, but he looked at his mind. And that is how he became enlightened. He actually went through and he looked at his mind, and what does all of that mean? He became enlightened. And at that point, that's when he became the Buddha. So Shakyamuni Buddha, we're going to go through some of these things. Shakya means clan, Muni means sage, and Buddha means enlightened one. What does enlightenment mean? Removing all obscurations, all negative states of mind, fully developing all virtuous states of mind, all positive states of mind, and that's becoming enlightened. It sounds kind of silly. We did this last week. I'm going to do it again because we're going to get these things up on the board. Okay. Give me, let's do a different color just because I can, pink. Positive states of mind. Do it again. There's new people. So this is a shout out. What are positive states of mind?
Happiness.
Contentment.
Gratitude.
Keep going. I'm sorry?
Peacefulness.
Fulfillment.
Love. Compassion. Okay. So now, would that list could go on. What are some negative states of mind?
Anger.
Anxiety.
Fear.
Jealousy.
Pessimism.
Sadness. Okay, so you can get an idea. You can just go through and make your own list. Okay, if you could fully develop your positive states of mind, if you had the choice and you could fully develop your positive states of mind and you could get rid of all negative states of mind, would you not be a happier person? Okay, this is really kind of a duh to me. Okay, happier. If you could get rid of this and never be angry again, if you never felt anxiety, you never felt fear, you never felt, I haven't a clue what that says,
jealousy.
You were never jealous again. Okay? If you could get rid of all of these things, we'd be happier. This is all about our minds and becoming happier, kinder, gentler people. And Buddhism says you can do this. Buddhism says that every human being, every sentient being, has the ability and the power to do this. It is possible. That's Buddhism in a nutshell, right there. And it sounds so easy. Just be happy. Just be kind. Just be loving. Okay, so we've got a question. Here's my deal with questions. Who's got the mic? You've got a mic. Okay, so he's back there in the corner. So we're going to use the mic to ask questions. It helps for the room to hear, and it also helps. We're recording this. You guys are not on camera, so you don't have to worry about it. But there's nothing more frustrating when somebody asks a question and you didn't hear it on the recording. So, yes, sir, your question.
Do the teachings say how many people, humans, have become enlightened?
Nope. Millions. Because you have to think, it's not just humans. Okay, so we know how many humans are on this planet, right? Remember I said not just humans, all sentient beings. Do you have any idea how many insects there are on this planet?
A lot.
Okay, and I'm not even get into the fact that do we think that this is the only planet with life? Do we think that this is the only universe? Okay, so it's...
So the insects make a conscious effort to...
They have the ability... They have the ability, and we're going to talk about, so these are great questions. Keep asking them, okay?
And the insects do the pose and the dogma behind
nope,
the teachings?
No, because you know what? That's great. This is great. So remember that question on about class 4, okay? Because what we're going to get into is the precious human life and why we have the opportunity right now and why this makes it so special, because insects and animals don't have that opportunity right now. But because of karma... which we're going to talk about in class 3, this will all make sense. So the great question, okay, but that's why we consider our life to be a precious human life, because we have the opportunity to work with our minds. We have the opportunity to be able to do this. And not only do we have that opportunity as humans, think about how much of an opportunity we have, because we're sitting in Raleigh, North Carolina, at a Buddhist center where we've got access to the teachings. We have a truly beautiful human life. There's also people that have human lives that don't have this opportunity, okay? Somebody that's living in a war-torn country, somebody that, you know, has some kind of mental impairment, or, you know, is in a coma, or I could list all kinds of humans that don't have this opportunity that we have. And you have it because of your karmic background. And we're getting that's class 3. Next week. forget, maybe touch it. But remember that question, because that's a very good question. We say that we have all mind bearers. Everybody that possesses a mind has the ability to do this. And that's part of what we call Buddha nature. I'm going to start bouncing around with some things, okay? It's that Buddha nature, that mind. We have the opportunity to become Buddhas. We all have the innate nature to become Buddhas. Another analogy is if I had an acorn, all right, I've got an acorn. Well, y'all know what an acorn looks like. Well, what truly is an acorn? If you water it, if you take care of it, it gets sunlight, it's going to grow up into an oak tree, right? So its nature is to become an oak tree. Its nature is to become an oak tree. A mind bearer's nature is to become a Buddha with the right causes and conditions, with watering and some sunlight, pulling those. Does that make sense? Okay, so we'll get there. This is, again, we're just touching the surface of it. So our nature is to become Buddhas. Okay, and there are lots of Buddhas. Shakyamuni Buddha is the historical Buddha. There were many Buddhas before him. There are many Buddhas after him. There's a weird practice that I can do sometimes because it's a way for me to learn. Buddhas are there to help teach us, right? And so I can actually play a little game where you all are Buddhas and I'm not, and you all are asking me questions, or I'm here just for this. Like I said, it's all about learning to work with your mind. And so it's you never know who that other person is. Okay? We can akin this somewhat in a Western philosophy of angels among us. You know, we all know those stories and stuff. Same thing, same type of thing. Somebody in this room could be a Buddha and we just don't know it. Okay? So it's, again, it's just trying to get you to understand some of these concepts. Okay?
Is this room, will they know they're a Buddha?
Oh, yeah. They know.
Oh, okay.
Yes. She asked me if they're in this room, do they know it? If you're a Buddha, you know it. But you don't say it. Okay? Another question. And again, so we're kind of skipping. We'll explain some of these things. So I want the questions, and I'll try to tell you if we need to hold off on the answer, but let's bring them.
Well, looking at what's called the negative aspect,
yep.
A lot of those are protections.
They can
keep us alive, like the fear or the anger. I didn't really see them as having as something that we could, that we would want to override.
Well, I love you. That's really great. These are that's a good concept, okay? So somebody will take, so you don't have to, okay? So you're saying if there's the some things are protection, okay, from that outside world that keeps you alive. So one of the things we're going to talk about and differentiate from is this ultimate concept and then a conventional concept, okay? So conventionally, absolutely. If you're in a dark alley and somebody and you've got fear and that helps you get out of there, do it. That's conventional, okay? A lot of what we're talking about is our ultimate, okay? Anxiety for things. Trying to think of where it would be easier. Fear, jealousy. Most of these you actually don't. Jealousy, that's negative. I don't know that I could ever turn that into a positive. Anger, so give me an example. I've got one in my head. I just want to make sure we're on the same page. Where would anger be a positive? You're saying it would be to help keep you alive. So explain that one to me. I mean, I can go with it, but
yeah, I'm thinking like if somebody's in an attack situation,
okay,
maybe the anger, it's a physical.
Okay,
I'm thinking the physical that the anger would adrenaline.
Okay, adrenaline. You bring me adrenaline.
Adrenaline.
So I'm gonna go all Bruce Lee on you here. Okay, so if your mind is clouded with anger, you don't react well. If you had the training that you could react and defend yourself without the anger, right? that would probably be a little bit better, correct, than just that flash of anger. Now, the adrenaline, again, conventionally, it is actually fight or flight. Okay, that is our human response, fight or flight type of thing. That's what has kept us alive in many ways. But if we could learn to work with it a little bit so that we could learn how to do it wiser, would be better, correct? So it's trying to actually understand these things. And again, we're just going right along the surface here. But we have this flight or fight response.
I was just going to say the negative and the idea of sometimes negative, like, protects you. I think that's more like if something happens and somebody, you watching somebody being beaten up, and that upsets you, so then you react, but you don't then let that be digested in your body, that you've digested that, and now you just harbor that upset of what you've seen. You maybe take it into action, but you don't make it part of your DNA. So you're not walking around as a DNA anger person, a DNA jealous person. You don't own those emotions.
Some of the difference, what I think I can also say here is that we tend to use these words. I am angry. You're not. You feel anger, but if we just need to separate some of our language a little bit. I am, and we use an emotion. And so what we're talking about is, and we're going to get into this in a little bit with the mind, these things are part of the mind, but it is not what you are. So you have the choice. You can, how you choose to react to something is what we're kind of talking about here. But it is good to go through all of these things, and so it helps us. This is part of that looking at it, talking about it, discovering it. Do I, you know, theoretical knowledge versus experiential knowledge? So it's the talking about it so you can think about it for your own sake. But this is what we're saying, is that it is possible to focus and just have positive states of mind and lose all of the negative states of mind. Okay? And we say that that's enlightenment. That's the very definition of enlightenment right there. So let's start moving. So since Shakyamuni Buddha was not a god, he could not get up after he became enlightened and he got this knowledge. He couldn't get up and go, oh, I'm just going to give this knowledge to the world and now you are enlightened and you are enlightened. He couldn't do that. He was literally just a man. So he did the next best thing. He became a teacher. The definition of a teacher, the reason I have that up there is because in a Buddhist perspective, the definition of a teacher is way different than what our Western definition is. Our Western definition of a teacher, in many ways you guys are thinking I'm the teacher of this class, okay? I'm not. I say that I lead the class because we're in a Buddhist center, so I don't like to think of myself as a teacher. There's a big difference in the definition. You go to your college professor, those teachers, to gain this knowledge, and they're your teachers. In the Buddhist tradition, your teacher is a much more in-depth, way deeper meaning. If you have a student-teacher relationship, that teacher is responsible for you. You have to, we're going to talk about this more in class 5 a little bit, but you have a responsibility to that teacher. It's a much deeper relationship than our Western definition is. So, again, one of the things we're going to do in this class is we're going to be working on definitions because we have our Western definitions, our labels that we have all this baggage on or that we think of, and they're totally different than what we're talking about in Buddhism. So the teacher relationship is much different. But he became a teacher. He had students. Guess who his first students were? Those 5 monks that he originally hung out with when he was first did that whole ascetic thing. And they questioned. They saw him. They knew something was different. And it took them a while because he started explaining what he had discovered, and then they realized this is working for them. And so those were his first disciples. So he's not a god, just a guy, more similar to discoverers or scientists like Sir Isaac Newton and Einstein. He just had that kind of thing. Again, Buddhism is, in its purest form, is not a religion. It is a way of life. It's a philosophy. So the first major teaching that he did is the Four Noble Truths. We're going to get into that in a little bit. The turning of the wheel of Dharma. This is what they called when these great big teachings came out and really changed the world. These are terms that you're going to hear if you are reading about Buddhism or going on to any other classes. So turning the wheel of Dharma. What does Dharma mean? Dharma means that which protects, that which holds. Conventional Dharma is the teachings, the actual physical teachings. These, in these boxes up here, these are the 84,000 teachings of the Buddha. My computer, this PowerPoint is Dharma because it's got the teachings. This notebook is Dharma. It's got the teachings. This is conventional Dharma. This is this realistic conventional. Here it is. Ultimate realizations. The ultimate Dharma is those kind of those aha moments that you get when all of a sudden you get something. Oh, that's what that means. So when all of a sudden it becomes real to you that you kind of own it a little bit more, that's those aha moments. That's ultimate Dharma. That's when you kind of get it. Those are the aha moments. You're going to hear conventional and ultimate a lot. Conventional is this real world here, and ultimate is that aspiration. This is what we're... But the major takeaway here is everything in Buddhism, every single thing in Buddhism is about your mind. All of these prayer flags, all of these tankas, all of the symbolism up here, all of these statues, everything here is about how to work with your mind. And your mind is different than your mind is different than your mind. So this is about you learning to work with your mind. And how do we do that? How do we do that? That's what meditation is. Meditation is learning. It's a tool that we use to look and work with our mind. So the first teaching was the Four Noble Truths. It was in Bodhgaya. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path to the cessation of suffering. Again, suffering, suffering, suffering. It always sounds like Buddhism is such a depressing thing, and it's not. These monks and these people who study this are some of the most joyful people I have ever met. You can turn this around and say the truth of happiness, the truth of the cause of happiness, the truth of how to get happier, and the truth of the path. So this is the Four Noble Truths. And again, this is going to be the basis of the entire class, is this first thing. We're going to get into that. But once he taught this class, that's when it started spreading. I'm going to have to start moving faster. Spreading. India, Sri Lanka, Asia, Southeast Asia, China, Japan, Tibet. All of these different places that Buddhism went into. And like any other philosophy, like any other thing, once it goes into an area and a culture, it will start to take on the some of the trappings of that culture. That's why you see some of the different things. Like over in like Thailand, you'll see the Buddhas with the more pointier hats, or you know, China has some of the chubby Buddha, the happy Buddha. So it's all comes up from cultural, socio-geological aspects of these areas. It just the core is all the same. I don't care what the looks, the different colors. You know, Zen is very soft and green, a little bit quieter. Tibetan Buddhism is all about the bling. Okay, and the color. So it's only cultural differences. The core of Buddhism is always the same. The different strains of Buddhism. Theravadin, Hinayana, Theravadin, individual release from suffering. That's what nirvana is. Individual release from suffering. It is not enlightenment. It just means you yourself are released from the suffering. The Mahayana tradition is not only nirvana, but you reach this full enlightenment. They're both the same. They're both very similar. You can look at this where you can practice these both together, because if you're going to become a lifeguard, you have to learn how to swim before you can save somebody else. So they're both very similar. It's just different focuses. Tibetan Buddhism, where we are, there's four schools. All of them are found here in the West. They were founded over in Asia, but they're all found. You can find them here. Nyingma, Kagyu, Sakya, Gelug. Gelug, the spiritual leader of Gelug is the Dalai Lama. Now, why is this important? Okay, we're going to get into lineage here. It's very important in Buddhism that the lineage, what the teachings are, literally, our teacher, Geshe Gelug Choda, we have two monks here that are advanced students, 30-plus years over in the monastery. Geshe is a title, and one of them is Gelug Choda is his name. He's our main resident teacher, and Geshe Paulden Tsangpo. So we have two. We're fortunate to have two Geshes here. Geshe is a title, kind of like doctor. And Geshe Gelug is not only a Geshe, he's a Lhorampa Geshe, which is kind of like summa cum laude. So Geshe Gelug can literally tell you who his teacher was, who his teacher's teacher, teacher's teacher, teacher's teacher's teacher, okay, and take it all the way back. And the way that they do this lineage, it's an unbroken lineage directly through the Dalai Lama, directly back through to the Buddha. This is called the lineage, okay? Why is that important to us? Because we look at this more of a school, is because I know that we're going to get the authentic teachings of the Buddha, not a change. Not that there's anything wrong with these other, you know, philosophies or other schools, but I like knowing that the teachings that I'm receiving here at the center are exactly, go directly back. I can follow that lineage all the way back to the Buddha. It's no different than you're going to become an engineering student. You're going to look at those colleges that are really MIT. You're going to look at the places that really have that focus that you want, okay? So it's you're going to pay attention to what the lineage is. Those different schools just have a little bit different lineage, okay? Does that make sense? The Dalai Lama used to be the political leader of Tibet, and he gave that up, and now he's just the spiritual leader of the Gelug tradition, but all of the Tibetan traditions tend to look toward him too, okay? But you do have the Karmapa, you've got they each have their own leader, but everybody kind of looks to the Dalai Lama. And that's what started me. I started reading books of the Dalai Lama way back when I was young, and I was just always drawn to that. Make sense so far? Any questions? Okay. It's okay. I'm confused all the time.
If there were many Buddhas before and many after, I don't understand how the lineage goes back to the one.
Okay. So the lineage goes back to the one, but there were Buddhas prior to him. And when you get into Buddhism study, we just study the teachings of this historical Buddha, okay, of this man. We study the teachings of this man. Buddha is a title. Buddha is a title. It's a label. It doesn't mean a person. We tend to say the Buddha, right? But in all actuality, Buddha means enlightened one, and it's a title. It's a description. Okay, so we study the teachings of this historical Buddha because that this last 2,500 years is how it came to be, and all of these teachers that kind of helped to formulate the curriculum around this, that's what we study, these writings and stuff. But there were other Buddhas, okay, and we're going to try not to go deep diving on some of this stuff, but again, it is a title, a description, and there were, because the best way I can kind of tease on this is part of this rebirth type of situation, that we've all been here for way longer than the 59 years. Okay, so it's this whole evolution, rebirth, and cycle of your mind. And there were Buddhas before, and there are Buddhas after. There could very well be a Buddha sitting in this room. So that's just it's just a label of an enlightened mind. We just tend to talk about this Buddha as the historical Buddha. So this is just the man. Question. Yeah, Chris, you guys can chime in anytime if you want to add to this. But I've got a question over here. That, again, nobody's going to leave this class and go, oh, yay, I've got Buddhism down. Oh, I understand enlightenment. Oh, I understand karma. It's not going to be. My job is to help to clear some of these things away and answer your basic questions, and if you've got more, to kind of keep you going. But keep asking these things, and hopefully we can touch on it, and then slowly, hopefully by, you know, class four, you might go, oh, uh-huh, okay, I get that.
So I just wanted to follow up on your question. If I'm understanding the distinction right, there were other Buddhas
mm-hmm.
defined as enlightened minds
mm-hmm.
before the historical Buddha,
mm-hmm.
but those enlightened minds did not share teachings.
Not in the context of what we study, okay? But they did have teachings, but this was all kind of wrapped up with a bow by Lama Atisha and Lama Tsongkhapa, just in our, I don't want to say lifetime, but in our ability to understand. That's part of what, there's times where we have this opportunity where the Dharma is strong, and the Dharma is growing, and actually we're kind of in a waning. In some ways we're in a waning and a rising, but we just are in this evolutionary time, so to speak, that these teachings are ready and present and here. But just like the earth and the teachings and, you know, all of the things that came before Christianity, all the things that came before all of these other philosophies and stuff, there was something back then too. We just have this little kind of bow around these particular teachings with the Lam Rim, which we'll
available
talk about.
Available teachings.
Available. They're available to us in a language that we can understand. Another question over here.
It's not so much of a question, but I think what happens is that Sanskrit is the oldest language and cannot be translated. So if, you know, enlightened minds prior to the Buddha that we are learning about now, we wouldn't really be able to learn what they were teaching, because historians will tell you, and I even learned it in school, no one can translate Sanskrit. So what we have is what we're learning now. So like she said, Buddha is just a title. There are definitely other enlightened minds. We just wouldn't be able to translate what those teachings were or what they were talking about until Buddha, because the language was, you can't translate it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so everything is about the mind, developing positive states of mind, removing negative states of mind, and that's the definition. Developing these positive states of mind leads to happiness, removing negative states of mind that cause suffering. Okay, so we talked about some of this already, and now I want to get into the mind. And let's go here. Okay, so the definition of the mind. Let's go here. Non-physical, the mind is not the brain. It is not the brain. This is the Buddhist perspective of this. It is not the brain. It is clear, like a clear sky, clear lake, a mirror, aware. It has six senses. We kind of talk about the five, sight, sound, smell, touch, and taste. We're going to add mental awareness. The function of the mind is to know, and it has no beginning. So what does that break into? Synonymous with the word consciousness. It is not physical. It is not the brain. It is not the soul, this Christian idea of a soul. It is all of it, the entire spectrum of our inner experiences, intellect, thought, concepts, feelings, emotions, subconscious, your unconscious, your spirit, whatever you want to call this, your instinct, intuition, all of these inner experiences, all of these inner experiences that we have, that's the mind in a Buddhist concept. Your feelings and your emotions, all of this is the mind. So again, we're going to talk about this for a little bit because it's like, okay. In the Buddhist view, this is not created. The mind is not created by a superior being. It's not created by the Buddha. It's not created by God. In the Buddhist view, it's neither one of those. There was never this moment of creation. It was not created by your mom and dad. Your brain and your body certainly were. But in the Buddhist point of view, your mind has been this beginningless stream of mental moments. Yeah, this is where we're going to start getting into it. Yes, ma'am.
So I
been trying to separate these two things for a while, and maybe I just don't have a great understanding of what a soul is. Is the distinction something along the lines of spiritual systems that perceive a soul, take that soul to be kind of the sum total of what you are in this life, not changing? So if I could sort of lift my soul out of my physical body, there would be sort of a ethereal Margaret clone here, versus being the essence of what we are and what we take with us from lifetime to lifetime.
Okay, I can give you kind of my thought process on this, okay? But as I am not a theologian, to get into a definition of the soul, I'm going to be very careful of this. But as I say that, I'm going to do it. The soul, when you think about the soul from, you know, this Christian Western world, it is that essence of Sandy. Okay, so I'm just going to use myself for this. So Sandy, if you were looking at this from a Western perspective, my soul would be, you'd see, it would be Sandy. All of Sandy's good points and bad points, you just, that definition of here's Sandy's soul, right? Good and bad are all there. It's all that definition of there's Sandy. In the Buddhist perspective, that where it's your mind, which is clear, okay, all of these things, clear sky, that function is to know, continually changing, and if I can work on this to become enlightened, it is the pure, perfect Buddha nature. It doesn't have all the foibles and issues that Sandy has. Okay, this is part of what I find so empowering about this, is that in some ways I look at myself, Sandy is the holder of this mind during my lifetime. I have got this mind that I want to take care of. It's kind of like that environmental message. We want to save the world for our children, okay, or for those that come after us. That's kind of the way that I think of this, is Sandy is the bearer, the holder of this mind, and I'm going to pass it off to the next holder, and I want to do the best thing I can. I want to set that mind up and that being up for a better life next time, because I do believe this. Okay, so I kind of look at this as I've got that opportunity to hold this mind, to clear up some of the stuff and give that a better start. The soul, it's kind of this finite thing, that all of these foibles and everything that go with being Sandy, I am so not a perfect person. I've got so many issues and doubts, and it's kind of that I've got to rely, from the Western perspective, you almost in some ways have to rely on an outward being to fix this, whereas in Buddhist perspective, we work on it ourselves. So again, that's a very touchy type of thing, but it's just trying to, that's the way I tend to try to think about it. Does that help a little bit? That was kind of a Sandyism. I'm going to tell you that was definitely a Sandyism and not something that I've heard, okay? But it's just the way it helps me to think about it. You can look at the mind in some ways, okay? So I've got this water, okay, and if I dumped a bunch of dirt in here and shook it up, okay, that dirt is all mixed up with this water, okay. Think of this water as being that pure mind, and that dirt is all the negative stuff that's on top of there, and I can clean that dirt out. So the mind has this clarity. The things that we put on it are not intrinsic to it, okay. Does that make sense? So you're trying to think about it like this, so we can take this out, okay? And so then also you can look at this, that the mind, okay, it is agitated by all of these outward things that happen, okay? When if we can just stop it, it will fall back into its natural state, okay? So this mind is this, again, I'm just going to try to work, and the fact that we have the ability to work with our minds. We have the ability to change our minds. And I'm not saying changing our minds from I want to go to this restaurant instead of that. I'm talking about we literally have this opportunity and the ability to work with our mind to become a nicer, kinder, less angry, more loving, less jealous person. We can do this. And by doing that, The very fundamental concept in Buddhism is that this mind is continually changing. Our mind is continually changing, and we have the ability to change it. That firm belief that we have the ability to improve our own mind. So it's kind of like the river. So you can step into a river at one point, and the river is very turbulent, and it's like this. And you can step out, and you can go, and you can get in that same river, but the river's different down here. So it's that stream, that consciousness stream, that your mind is changing just like that river. I'm hearing that thing go off, so I'm figuring we're going to lose our PowerPoint here in a little bit. So how do we do it? Because we have the ability to work with our own minds and to create the causes of our own happiness. How do we do that? We look at our mind. We study and we practice. That's why you hear the term practicing Buddhism all the time. We practice. It's a practice. This is a school to us. It's not a religion. It's homework. We're working on it all the time. It's not, one day a week type of thing. We're trying to do this every day and sometimes even every moment of every day. That's kind of this mindfulness craze that goes on. Mindfulness is the study of Buddhism in many ways. So it's just pulling some of the trappings off so that it's very secular. So what do we study? We study the Lam Rim. The Lam Rim, all versions of the Lam Rim are elaborate elaborations of Lama Atisha's 11th century text, A Lamp for the Path to Enlightenment. This was the original Buddhism for Dummies. Okay, way back in the 11th century, this guy did this entire wrapping of all of these teachings. Okay, he kind of did a whole outline and context, and he wrote this book. And because we really don't study those teachings, we study the commentaries on the teachings. And the main commentary, especially from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, is the Lam Rim. And so we have out in that library, at the bookstore, you're going to find, 10 different commentaries on the Lam Rim. And again, it's just an organizational chart of Buddhist teachings. And it's a step-by-step graduated path. Literally, do this, do this, do this, do this. And if you do these steps and you're working on it, it should work. Now, the point is with Buddhism that just because the Buddha says it, just because we're reading it, does not mean that you accept it with blind faith. There is no blind faith in Buddhism. No blind faith. Just because he said it, you got to do it? Never. Ever. The whole point is to take these teachings, take them as theory, try them, look at them. If it works for you, great. If it doesn't, go to a different one or move on. You never take anything on blind faith. This is where you study it, you analyze it. The analogy is from back in the day that just the way that the assayer would look at a bar of gold and he would make sure that gold was pure, and if it's not pure and if it doesn't work for you, then move on. If you find it not to be true, then move on or change it. The Dalai Lama is doing this all the time, and he's very into science and all that, and the more they discover some of the things, he says if any of the scientific things, the scientific proofs and studies that are coming out, if they go against any of the teachings, then the teachings must change. Okay, and they study all of the meditation studies that you see. Most of them are using Tibetan Buddhist meditators. Okay, because they are the king of meditation, all of those things. You can look at the videos and stuff. But the Dalai Lama even says if something that science proves goes against the teachings, then the teachings have to change. So there's no blind faith in Buddhism. So what does it mean to be Buddhist? What does it mean to be Buddhist? Where do we look for our happiness? Okay, it's not to Buddhist. We look inside. What is happiness? So we need to kind of define what is happiness first. All right, so question. This is trains. We will be dealing with trains.
All right. So you said that if the scientific theories disprove or they contradict what has already been set in place, what if later on then the scientific theories are disproven themselves?
Well, that happens. So that's what happens with science. It'll go along and what is science? It's theory and testing and theory and testing. And So things change because of science, but then there's more theory and testing, and maybe it'll change back. I mean, this is the more that we discover. They've reclassified Pluto how many times? You know, so theory and stuff will change, but that's part of what I'm talking about. This is a working hypothesis, and you need to study it. Don't accept it. Test it. And the more, well, they're actually finding that the more that science is finding, the more that Buddhism is kind of working. But again, it's going to change. Science is as exact as it can be, but science itself is always changing because technology is advancing and things, they can look at quantum physics now. They couldn't do that, you know, so many years ago. Does that make sense? Did I answer?
Yeah. I'm just wondering, is anything in the Buddhist faith, do you ever accept anything just on faith, or is it all, like, philosophically kind of ingrained?
Okay, so, do you ever accept? So there's no blind faith. There's different kinds of faith, though, okay? I've been working with Geshe Gelug for 12 years now, and I have faith in him and his teachings. So if he says something that I don't quite get, which happens all the time, okay, I will trust in him. I will have faith that he knows what he's talking about, that I just don't get it yet. So I have a kind of a, it's not blind faith, but I've got a trust, I've got a faith in him that, you know, I'm going to give that a try. Because I've been working with him long enough now that I've got faith in him that, okay, that's going to work. And if it doesn't, then I can talk to him about it, and then it's something else. So there's other things. Kind of like going into the supermarket, you know, what is going to work for you? Because your mind and my mind are totally different. Okay, so it's just one of these things. Every mind in here is different. There may be a group of us that really likes the counting the breaths meditation. There's a group of us that think that's the stupidest thing ever. Okay, so, but there's no blind faith, but there is kind of that trust faith just from experience. Does that make sense? There's actually, I'm not going to get into it, but there's actually three or four different levels of faith. But there's never blind faith in Buddhism. Make sense? So what is happiness? Let's talk about what is happiness. Now again, we have conventional or temporary happiness. You know, I'm probably going to be getting a new iPhone pretty soon. That's going to make me temporarily happy, right? Until I have glitches with it, and then I'm going to have problems with it. What else? What are the things that make you, what is, you know, we talk about making you happy. We have this in our Western culture all the time. I'll be so happy if I get that new computer. I'll be so happy if I get that new job. I'd be so happy if I would get a new boss. I would be so happy. I mean, just think about it, you know. It's all out there, isn't it? If happiness was really out there, then we could define it, and then if I could have everybody in this room get that one thing, we'd all be happy, wouldn't we? So we see it, we read it all the time in the news that some rich person, they're not happy, they, you know, committed suicide or whatever. So happiness obviously isn't money. Could it make my life easier? Absolutely. I'm not saying that. But that's the temporary happiness. Okay? That's conventional happiness. If it was really out there, then just by having that one thing, we'd all be happy. We could just do it. So where do we look for happiness? What is happiness? Is it freedom from suffering, really? I mean, in the bottom line, freedom from suffering, to just never have any of that happen, I'd be really happy about that. So it's where do we look for happiness? Buddhists look inside. We're not looking out there. Now, it's not to say we're not going to enjoy all of this stuff out there. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. It does not mean giving everything up. In fact, it means I'm going to enjoy it even more because I appreciate it and I understand it even more. Okay, so it doesn't mean giving everything up. It just means that I know where the happiness is and I know how to work with my mind a little bit better, and I'm working on it. So that if I don't get that new iPhone, you know, next week, I'm not crushed over it. Or if I get a piece of chocolate cake when I ordered carrot cake at the restaurant, I'm not going to be upset over it. It's just that kind of ever-changing, how do you deal with some of these things. The Four Noble Truths, we're going to go through some of these real quick. I'm going to put these up now so we can get over there and talk about it. So, again, we talked about this. The Four Noble Truths is the first teaching that the Buddha gave. And it's really, you can wrap up everything in this teaching. Okay, the first noble truth, the truth of suffering, admit you're sick. You just know that you've got to work on something, right? Second noble truth, the truth of the cause, you get the diagnosis. It actually gets kind of laid out. You get that diagnosis of what it is. The third noble truth, the truth of the cessation, you get the medicine. And then the fourth noble truth of the path, actually take the medicine. Let's just simplify some of these things. I know I'm chubby. I know I need to lose weight. I know it. All right? I can get the diagnosis. There's a lot of reasons that I'm chubby, besides the fact that I just don't do a lot of things. I had a lot of medical stuff. Medication did this. I can have all the excuses in the world, but I'm going to get the diagnosis. You know what? The diagnosis, and then I got the treatment. Go to the gym. Stop eating so much. Okay? Start working out. And now I actually have to do it. I know that I need to lose weight. I know it. But now I have to actually do it. Why is it so hard? Everything in your life actually can come down to these things. It's really a good methodology for starting to work with these things, right? We set an intention at the beginning of this class. In fact, we talked at the last class where I said try to set an intention for your day. If you remember, set an intention for your day and then dedicate at the end of the day. This was the start of a new year. So one of the things that we all did, how many people made resolutions? That was our intention for the year, right? We want to change these things. We want to change these things. In however many years you've been doing resolutions, New Year's resolutions, how many times have you actually achieved them? Okay, because you probably didn't actually set yourself a path to do it. You had the intention, I'm gonna go to the gym, I'm gonna get a new job, whatever that is, I'm gonna be a nicer person, whatever that intention is, whatever that New Year's resolution, but then you actually have to do these steps, right? So it's like, this is it. My husband is a prime example, okay? He's, you know, I'll finally get him to go to the doctor and we'll get that medicine home, take it for a couple of days, and then it's like, yeah, I'm feeling better, and he'll stop. So it's just following these steps. So this entire class, we're going to be coming into this stuff and trying to break this down so that we understand how to get through some of this. I've got to start moving faster. So suffering. So we're going to talk about what actually, from our Western perspective, suffering is a word that we tend to use for we've got our own definition of that, and I'm going to change it. Now when we talk about suffering from the rest of this class, I want you to think of the word dukkha. I want you to think of the word dukkha. When we say suffering, I want you to think dukkha. We're not talking about suffering. We're talking about dukkha. Why? So the suffering dukkha, suffering from a Buddhist perspective, there's three different kinds. The first one is suffering of pain. This is the obvious. This is the one we normally talk about, the ow. I broke my leg, I've got a cold, I'm sick. This is the normal suffering that we tend to talk of and we speak of when we mean suffering. Suffering also means suffering of change, the anxiety or stress of trying to hold on to things that are constantly changing. This is your anxiety, okay? Why do we have anxiety? Because something's happening out there, right? Things are changing. It's usually changing. Something's happened to change. So it's the suffering of change. And this is more anxiety. These are mental afflictions, right? It's all about your mind. The pervasive compounded suffering. It's a basic unsatisfactoriness. That's a word. Pervading all forms of life becomes all forms of life are impermanent and constantly changing. This is really just life by its very nature is difficult. It's flawed and imperfect. This isn't a judgment. It's just a fact. Because we are living, we're suffering, okay? Our loved ones are going to die. We're all going to die. We tend to go through this life like we're not going to, but none of us is going to make it out of here alive. We're all going to have some kind of medical issues. We're all suffering from anxiety, okay? We all have these different issues. It's really, this is one of the reasons y'all are checking out Buddhism and meditations, because you're struggling with things most of the time, trying to figure out how to deal with things. So this is suffering. So it's not just the ow. It's all of the mental afflictions that we're going to talk about too. Okay, so when we say suffering from now on, I want you to think dukkha, so that we get that larger meaning of it. The truth of the cause of suffering. So what is that? Why do we suffer? Why do we suffer? These, remember I told you at the beginning, for those of you that weren't sure, I'm going to say it again. Buddhism, especially Tibetan Buddhism, is that list. They'll have 10 of these and 6 of these and 4 of these and 29 of those and 32 of those. And it's a way of compartmentalizing so that we can, again, wrap our minds around it and that we have this actual structure to work with. So this, the truth of the cause of suffering that they're saying is that there are 6 root delusions. Ignorance, anger, attachment, pride, doubt, and wrong view. I'm going to spin through this. We'll talk about this a little bit more in class because I really want to get through at least this much and then do another meditation. I can't believe the time blew that fast. Okay. Ignorance. Literally not seeing that which exists or the way in which things, we don't really see things the way that they really are. We're going to this much more deeper next time, I promise. There are basically 2 kinds, ignorance of karma and ignorance of the ultimate truth. We'll go into all of these things much deeper. The fundamental delusion from which all others spring, the first of the 12 links of dependent origination. Again, these are big Buddhist words. We'll talk about them in a little bit. But the fundamental delusion from which all, so that this, we're going to start, this is all is going to fold back into the positive and negative states of mind. Anger, a disturbing thought that exaggerates the negative qualities of an object and wishes to harm it. Attachment, that's a big word. We're definitely going to go into that more next time because attachment in a Western, we think I'm very attached to my husband, I'm very attached. We tend to think of that as a good word, I'm attached. But in Buddhism, the Buddhist definition is going to be, it's a very negative word because it comes up with the, it's all about the ego being involved with it. We'll go into that in much more detail next time. But attachment is a disturbing thought that exaggerates the positive qualities of an object and wishes to possess it. Pride, the love of one's own excellence. Pride is the specific feeling through which egoism manifests. Sometimes pride can be good. Okay, some pride is one of those funny words that sometimes can be good for different things. There's divine pride where you've got kind of this good thing, but a lot of times pride is, it's a very negative word. And again, we'll go into this in more detail next time. Wrong doubt, healthy doubt prevents us from succumbing to blind faith. So a healthy doubt is okay. Healthy doubt, you're going to check it out. That's okay. But it doubt that denies basic truths. Severely impedes your development, okay? So doubt can be a funny thing sometimes. Wrong view, any mistaken or deluded understanding that leads to suffering. Sounds like a bunch of that. We're going to go into this, I promise. In Buddhism, there are various ways of defining wrong views. The most common one is heresy, okay? You know this, you've learned this, but you're going to teach against it. Confuse people. Take people for your own agenda, okay? Those who would take the Buddhist teachings, start a school to get money, okay? So that type of thing, heresy. Extreme views of the superiority. My way is better. Buddhism is better than anything else. That's wrong view. It's, we have respect for all different spiritualities, all different cultures, all different religions, all different philosophies. The views of superiority, of morality and discipline. I'm better than you. It's basically watching out for that wrong view. Okay, so, wow, we're going to stop here. I just lost time. But we'll get into how do we stop this. And Nirvana, we're going to talk about karma. We'll go into this a little bit different or deeper so that you understand truly how the mind can be beginningless and endless. But I promise I'm always going to try to stop on time. And we just went through it. Is there any questions? Everybody kind of got understood everything, right? Totally. Which one? Let's do. This is a nice brief one. Again. Part of this going into just a brief meditation at the beginning and the end is just how to start learning to work with your mind. The analogy I gave last time is that we're a mechanic working on a car that's racing down the freeway. Question in the back. Oh, go ahead. Thank you.
I noticed when everybody gave positive aspects like love and so on and so forth, it took a long time to do that.
I know.
But the negative...
That's a great awareness.
Came off like it was, you and I were saying ABCD.
Yeah.
How do we go about changing and thinking more on the positive side than we do the negative side?
Come next week. I promise we will do that. So part of it is meditation, because you get to choose, okay? Who's in charge of your mind? Stop and think about this for a second. Who's in charge of your mind? Is your mind in charge of you? Or can you control your mind? So it's a little bit of both right now, isn't it? It's that monkey mind or elephant. Your mind is this great big elephant that you're trying to grab and say, get over here. And sometimes we just swirl, right? That's part of that learning, how to control your mind. Because who's in charge? Are you in charge? Or is your mind in charge of you? This is part of what we're going to be discovering, and how do we learn to work with our mind. Again, we're a mechanic working on a car that's racing down the freeway. This is not easy, but it is doable. And there's the little tools and tricks and tips to do that, and that's what this path is all about, okay, and learning these things. And again, we just we'll go through it. We'll get there. Next week we'll talk about these things in much more detail, and I'll give you some of those little tips and tricks. Again, one of the things we talked about was setting an intention for your day. The first thing when you wake up in the morning, you get to decide what kind of day you're going to have. You may not be able to control what happens to you during the day, but you certainly can control how you react to them. Okay, so if you get up in the morning and say, you know what, I'm going to try to have a good day. I'm going to try to be nice to everybody, even that person who pisses me off at work. I'm just going to give it a try. At least I'm not going to yell at them. At least I'm just going to walk away. Whatever it is, just control it as much as you can. Okay, and at the end of the day, when you're laying there in bed, just think, okay, go through your day. How did it go? There's things I did really well. I was aware of my mind today. I was aware of these things going on, and I did pretty good. You know, there's some things I can do better. Never beat yourself up. This is never about beating yourself up. We're doing the best we can. It's being gentle with yourself. Never beat yourself up. Maybe I'll do one of those meditations too, so that you can kind of understand that you're doing the best that you can. There's always room for improvement, but you're doing the best you can. But there are little things that you can do. That's what meditation is. Becoming familiar with your mind so you can see these things. Do any of you use any of like those mindfulness bells on your phone? Okay, so there's different ways that you can kind of wake up, because we tend to go through our days just mindlessly, okay? And all of a sudden it's like, you ever do that? Oh, it's 2:00. Wow, where did the time go? It's 3:00. Sometimes I don't even remember how I got to that meeting. It's just that mindless thing. So it's about trying to be more aware. If we're more aware of our mind as much as we can be, there's mindfulness bells, there's different things. There's triggers. I'll use triggers. Okay, the red light. That used to be a thing that would piss me off because I'm going to be late. I hit every single red light on the way here tonight. Okay, but a long time ago, I learned that that's one of my triggers. And so I use red lights now. My thing is there's a 100-syllable mantra that, mind protector, we'll get through all this later, but I'll try to, now when I get to that red light, I'll start to say that mantra. It's a prayer, okay? A mantra is a prayer, and I will try to say that, and now it's actually, I'm trying to do this long prayer before that light changes, so I've actually turned this red light now instead of a negative. Now I'm trying to, hold on to that red light before, okay, now it can turn. So it's how do I change my mind to be less impatient. So I'll talk about that, but there's different things you can do. And it's these little, just like you're going to go to the gym. You're going to go work on the arms, you're going to go work on your legs. Same thing with this. I'm going over time. Okay, I did it again, so I'm going to do it again. For those of you that want to leave, go ahead and go. Class is over. Thank you for coming. For those of you that want to stay for a very brief meditation, but I always promise to end on class on time, and I'm 3 minutes over. So if anybody wants to leave, it's okay. It's really okay. Don't apologize. Just go. It's okay. And for those of you that want to stay, I'm having a fun time deciding what I want to do. This is shorter. I'll do this one. Very brief meditation. How many of you, raise your hand if you need me to walk you through the 7-point posture again. If you want me to do it, we can do it. If we don't, then we're just going to go into it. And all of these handouts are on, most of these handouts, now I have to clarify, most of these handouts are up on the website. So get yourself in that comfortable position. Just let the thoughts of the class go a little bit. Don't worry about anything. Just bring your attention and focus right into your breathing, your posture. Get comfortable and focus your attention on your breathing. Breathe naturally. Focus your mind on the rising and falling of your shoulders and chest as you inhale and exhale gently. Allow your mind to settle, become calm and present, ready to engage in meditation. Again, we're going to set a motivation. We're going to create an altruistic motivation for this session. We are meditating not just for our own individual benefit, but we're going to take the time now to meditate. Start to work with our mind, hoping to become a wiser and kinder person that would benefit all beings, including yourself. Always include yourself in that wish. Imagine you're lying on your back on a hill and have a totally unobstructed view. When you look up there is the clear spaciousness of a luminous blue sky, that Carolina blue. Sometimes the distractions of the mind will create obstructions in the view of the mountains and buildings and trees, but your job in this meditation is to move those out of the way, merging yourself as much as possible with that clear, luminous spaciousness of the sky. When you notice thoughts and feelings and distractions coming to clutter up the spacious luminosity, kind of see them like clouds that are passing through the sky. The clouds arise, they abide in the space for a while, and then they move and disappear. And the sky is once again clear spaciousness. It's the same for your mind. When these thoughts come, do not attach to or grab a hold of them, just watch them. Like clouds, they have no essence. Let them go. Watch them pass away. And return your awareness to that clear, spacious, blue sky. Everything that arises, thoughts, emotions, feelings, and sensations, the experience of sound, smells and so forth, has the nature of spacious, luminous clarity, formless, space-like, clear awareness. This is the pure nature of your consciousness. Totally relax. Stay like this for several minutes. This intense awareness of that blue sky. Think of your thoughts like clouds passing and let them go. We'll do for 2 minutes. bring your attention back to the room. And the dedication this time will be dedicate as much as possible to remember the spaciousness in your mind. It is part of how the mind truly exists. It's the very nature of your mind. And dedicate in this way to being able to connect yourself again and again with the space so that it will be a benefit for you and ultimately allow you to be a benefit to others. Thank you. Thanks for coming. I promise I'll move a little faster next time. Great question, too. Excellent. Thank you so much.